Hello, this is Clinton Powell from australiacounselling.com.au, and it's my very great pleasure to be here today with Dr. Rick Hansen, who is a neuropsychologist and author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love and Wisdom, which has now been printed in 21 languages. And his other book is called Just One Thing, Developing a Buddha Brain, One Simple Practice at a Time. He is the founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom, and an affiliate of the Greater Good Science Centre at UC Berkeley. He's been an invited speaker at Oxford, Stanford and Harvard, and taught in meditation centres worldwide. And Rick's weekly e-newsletter, which I always look forward to reading, is called Just One Thing and has over 37,000 subscribers. And you can sign up for his newsletter at his website, which is at rickhansen.net. So welcome, Rick. It's lovely to have you on the call.
Great, Clinton, and greetings to Australia. As we were talking offline, my brother lives there. I'm a major fan of the country, and I have a lot of heart connection with Australia and its people.
Thank you very much. Well, I've titled this talk today, Mindfulness for Therapists, How Buddha's Brain Can Help You Become a More Effective Clinician. And I'd love to know a little bit about your journey as a therapist. How did you become to be interested in Eastern traditions as a therapist?
Yeah, I actually started out with an interest in the Eastern traditions, and then about 10 years later, I got interested in becoming a therapist. So my initial encounter was with the Eastern traditions in general, Buddhism in particular. It was in 1974. I was young, and I had long hair and gold-rimmed glasses, and I'd play a wind flute out in the hills meditating. I thought I was very groovy, you know. But slowly but surely, some wisdom, bang, 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 sank in. And anyway, in my 30s, I started training as a therapist and became a psychologist. And after that, I got more and more interested in integrating, really, the neuroscience stream with the contemplative wisdom stream into the psychotherapy stream. Because to me, when, if you just imagine the center of three circles, you know, neurology, psychology, and contemplative practice, right at the center of those three circles, there's a lot of good value. And I think what moved me personally in that regard, I've just always been interested in the deep causes of things, and also I've been interested in effectiveness. You know, what's the root of the issue, and what's really going to make the most difference to make it better? And so to me, brain science combined with contemplative wisdom offered a phenomenal manual of the deep structure of the mind, as well as a toolbox for making efforts over time to use the mind to change the brain to benefit the mind. And that, you know, led me down my path. And I've used it personally, of course, as well as in my practice.
Well, I'm curious to know, what did you discover when you started to bring in mindfulness practices personally and with your clients?
I found, I'll be honest, that often clients resisted them, and which was interesting. Right. And so I was trained in part psychoanalytically, so I try to pay attention to the whole idea of transference, the frame, and what's it like for a client, for a therapist to start teaching some particular skill or method, let alone a skill or method that has some kind of woo-woo Eastern religious connotations in the minds of still many people. What's that actually like? So I think it's important to pay attention to that. That said, I also found that much of traditional psychotherapy is mindfulness by other words. If you think about Freud's notion of the observing ego, or the analyst's evenly hovering attention, or the principle in psychoanalysis of analytic neutrality, a lot of that is very much about, it's very akin to or harmonious with, or the synonymous with, really, a lot of language about mindfulness. So I got that. And then I also got that talking about mindfulness in its own right, in a way that demystified it and made it very ordinary. That one nice thing about some knowledge of the brain is that it lets you talk about something like mindfulness in a very matter-of-fact way, and in a way that often appeals to people, frankly, often men, not always, but people in general, who are very practical and need some kind of physical, material, scientific explanation for things, then they'll be much more motivated to it. So when I could speak of mindfulness in this way, I found that people were naturally much more interested in it and were willing to, oh, try it out. I mean, the basic idea of observing is good. But as we know, there are these additional factors that are not pure mindfulness, but are very associated with it, such as an attitude of acceptance or friendliness, or a quality of compassion or kindness toward oneself altogether. And as people begin using those more and more, the fruits were juicy. They liked the rewards, and then that motivated them further to keep doing it.
So you're saying you found you had to find a way to language it a little bit differently depending on the populations you were working with?
Yeah, I found myself talking about, I wouldn't even use the word mindfulness sometimes. I talk about paying attention. Or are you able to step out of the movie of your life and observe it from 20 rows back with popcorn, going, wow, that's intense, but which is really different than being glued to the screen. Everybody understands that difference, right? And I would do, I think there are basically four ways as therapists we get our clients one way or another to do anything that's useful. One is that we just implicitly draw them into it. So for example, like other therapists would, I would encourage moments of mindfulness in the therapy hour. I would talk with people about, for example, what are you experiencing? What's under the surface of what you're experiencing? And then I would draw their attention to the metacognitive, meta-attentive aspects of this. What are you noticing about this process of stepping back from your sensations, your feelings, your desires, your thought processes? And what are you noticing about regarding your mind as a kind of parfait with multiple layers and then looking down below the surface? What's that like for you? You know, just that kind of ordinary language without dropping in the M word, let alone the B word for Buddhism,
yes.
Just simply the M word alone. I found that really, really went well. And I would also bring it to bear in any kind of performance capacity. I mean, my own view is that psychotherapy is a lot of things, but centrally it is about learning and unlearning, learning and unlearning. And the question then becomes how to learn well. Well, learning is a matter of acquiring competence. It's about getting good at things. Mm-hmm. And I think there's no way around that. And I think that some therapists in some schools, some traditions, tie themselves in verbal knots trying to avoid accepting the reality that we're endlessly influencing our clients. And they are endlessly to pursue goals of one kind or another. The only pragmatic question is, how's it going? In other words, is it going well or badly? So in that context, talk about how people endlessly appreciate the fact that if they want to get good at riding a bike or using chopsticks, back, are we back? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, great. Sorry, we had a little walk on the internet, but I was just saying that people also appreciate that anytime they're learning anything, like I said, riding a bike, using chopsticks, the latest version of Windows, they appreciate that to do that, they have to step back from what they're doing and observe what they're doing and reflect on what they're doing and just be with what they're doing. And then they go, oh, the same is true with my mental reactions and getting competent with my mind, not just my chopsticks.
I love your metaphor of the movie theater because we can all relate to sitting in a movie theater with popcorn and just kind of encouraging people to step back and observe and develop an awareness of what they're doing and how they're doing it as well. It's a lovely metaphor. Yeah. Tell us about studies. I'm interested, are there any studies about the efficacy of therapists that cultivate mindfulness for themselves or maybe perhaps don't even use it in sessions but do practice mindfulness personally?
That's interesting, Clinton. There are a lot of studies on bringing mindfulness-based methods in one form or another, both very formal trainings like MBSR, as well as more informal or adapted protocols. There's a lot of research on the benefits of that, as well as the benefits of meditation, which is the epitome, really, of a mindfulness practice. There are a lot of studies on the benefits of that for physical health conditions, for mental health conditions, and for ordinary well-being, as well, pardon me, as studies on the ways in which some kind of personal mindfulness practice can help improve clinician effectiveness and reduce clinician burnout. I'm not specifically aware of any studies that have been done on therapist effectiveness, psychotherapist effectiveness through mindfulness training, but I'm sure there have been, and I'm sure that studies have been done both on what's called trait mindfulness, in other words, our disposition, our basic quality, as well as state mindfulness, in other words, the degree to which we enact mindfulness in our therapy, or that we can train in mindfulness. So it, just as a small point here, if people want, they can go on my website, rickhanson.net, rickhanson.net, and go to the tab called Media, and then down to Slide Sets. That's a repository of all this, of almost all the slide sets of everything I've ever taught, including many, many workshops for therapists, including a slide set for a workshop I did for psychiatrists on the benefits of mindfulness in clinical practice. And because this was for the medical profession, there was a very high bar I needed to meet in terms of the research that I cited there. And so if people want, it's bulletproof. They can go to that slide set, and I think it's, I think also posted on my website is a set of citations that relate to what's in the slide set. And they can use that if, however they like. It's freely offered material, which really substantiates my point here about the power of mindfulness in clinical practice. I mean, it's interesting to appreciate. It's a simple fact that if a large pharmaceutical company like Merck or Pfizer could patent MBSR or patent meditation or patent any kind of mindfulness-based intervention, we would be seeing ads for it all night long. I'm assuming on Australian television, for sure on American television, we'd be seeing these ads all night long touting the benefits of mindfulness or meditation for all kinds of physical health conditions as well as mental health conditions too.
Yes, and thank you for sharing that resource. I imagine that was a tough crowd presented to psychiatrists, so thank you.
I like a tough crowd. It was good. It put me on my toes. But you're right, yeah. But I, you know, I, if I could interrupt you, sorry. You know, I've been in the profession formally for about 25 years, informally for about 35 years, and I've just seen this kind of, often this feeling like of being second-class citizens in the world of mental health as therapists, psychologists, counselors, mental health professionals of various kinds, social workers. And the truth is, honestly, the tools in our toolbox, the psychotherapeutic, the mental tools, the psychological tools, as opposed to the physical tools that are in the physician's or psychiatrist's toolbox, the tools we have are generally much more powerful than the tools that are available in the physician's box. Mm. And much, much, much research has supported that. There's a kind of lie floating around that mental health interventions are somehow a last resort or this sort of poor cousin in the healthcare field. And actually, we have the most powerful tools of all. And I think it's really important to have confidence in what our tradition, our discipline knows, and in confidence in the tools at our disposal.
That's such a great point. And part of what inspired me to contact you, Rick, and speak about this is I know in my personal practice, my own meditation practice has really, I guess in a way, kept me sane over many years working with clients. And I don't know, I probably would have burnt out, as you mentioned before, many years ago without it. But what are some of the benefits you see for therapists developing contemplative practices and developing a mindful approach to their life and their work?
Yeah. Well, I'd say several come immediately to mind. One is that by training in mindfulness, number one, we develop greater steadiness of mind. That's a fundamental aim of mindfulness training, is to be able to sustain. It's anyone can be mindful for a single exhalation, even a whole breath. But do 10 of those in a row. Do 10 tens in a row, which is a little over 5 minutes for most people. That is really challenging.
Yes.
Which is quite striking if you think about it. It's a really low bar. Pay attention to 100 breaths in a row. And yet anyone who's tried to do it, me included, appreciates how humbling it is to make that effort. So one thing that happens is that we develop greater steadiness of mind, which is fundamentally necessary to be a therapist, to be able to sustain attention to our clients, including hour after hour, if we have a full practice. The second thing that mindfulness does is it trains us in metacognition. In other words, paying attention to attention. We're much more able to track the movements and the subtle shifts in our own focus and put in little corrections as we go. That, too, I think improves therapeutic efficacy. Third benefit, mindfulness is the foundation of equanimity. By becoming more aware of our own internal reactions and the process in our client, we are able to build up a growing quality of equanimity so that we can stay connected with our client and present with our client. We can lean into them emotionally, if not physically, while at the same time not being knocked about by their reactions. I think also, this is a good segue to a very important point, and one that I'm actually doing some writing and I'll be doing some teaching about. I think mindfulness, I'm sorry to utter the heresy here, I think mindfulness has gotten overrated in the field of psychotherapy and in contemplative practice, especially Buddhism in the West in the last several decades. I think mindfulness is critically important. Of the three great movements, if you will, or undertakings, when we're dealing with healing, distress and dysfunction, or everyday well-being, or personal growth, or spiritual practice, I think the three great undertakings, to be with what's there, to be aware of it, to be mindfully present with it, to experience the experience, feel the feelings, know ourselves, and investigate beneath the surface, that's incredibly important. But also, it's important to remove or release or let go of or gradually abandon or prevent or uproot what's problematic in the mind. Not just be with it, but get rid of it, frankly. And then third, the great movement is to build up positive factors, often to replace the negative one that we release. In effect, if the mind were like a garden, mindfulness is like being aware of the garden without being disturbed by it. That's fantastic. But we also need to pull weeds and plant flowers in the garden of our mind and therefore our brain. So to me, all three of these are really, really, really important. And I think mindfulness is the most important of all. It's foundational. It's the basis of the other two. You can't pull weeds or plant flowers without being aware of that process. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, mindfulness alone is often spoken of as if that's all you need, as if it has some kind of magic power. And mindfulness alone does not have magic power. For one, it itself is not equivalent to love or joy or bliss or realization, because mindfulness is just neutral, basically. Yeah. Also, while sometimes mindfulness lets you release negative things, pull those weeds, sometimes the weeds go away when you're just aware of them. You just keep witnessing them. After a while, they just somehow pass away. Great. But does that always happen? Often it doesn't happen. And mindfulness alone will not ever plant flowers other than mindfulness flowers in the garden of your mind. So to me, all three are really, really necessary. And interestingly, in contemplative practice, that's where I think the full toolbox is available to people. So in my own contemplative practice, I would say it's been very important for me to cultivate wisdom that has to do with the recognition of the transient nature of things, that things are coming and going all the time, and the ways that they're interconnected, so that any moment of existence has this kind of frothy, foamy quality in which it arises and disappears as fast as we recognize it. And that helps us increasingly, you know, see things in perspective and not get our knickers in a twist and not get so caught up with things that are difficult, not keep chasing after things that are going away inevitably, whether they're pleasurable or painful. And the other thing that I think contemplative practice can do is it really helps warm the heart. It can really help bring qualities of compassion and kindness and love more to the forefront of our consciousness, in part because we've taken in the good again and again and again and again of planting those flowers, you know, in the garden of our mind. So those aspects of contemplative practice, which, by the way, contemplative practice does not have a monopoly on, there are many ways to develop those wholesome qualities, obviously, not just through contemplative practice. But contemplative practice is a very powerful way to do that. When we develop those, then we can sustain mindfulness with our clients because we're not so rattled. We've got more equanimity and we have more care and compassion for them. And therefore, we're able to stay present longer.
I think
sorry about that long answer, but that was a lot I wanted to say.
That was a great answer, and just making me reflect on early on in my career how I suffered from a lot of anxiety, and I work with a lot of couples, and I think that I have seen that transformation, that equanimity. I'm able to hold myself and lean into the client, and I think my meditation practice has been an important part of that process as well. I'm able to manage and regulate my anxiety much more with those kind of high conflict couples. I am curious, you know, in terms of neuroscience, is there research, is neuroscience showing that mindfulness is helpful in the therapist-client relationship, in particular around attunement?
Well, that's interesting. I'm sure there are studies in that specific regard in terms of attunement. I'm just not aware of them. I will mention a resource that I really appreciate that others may like as well. It's called Mindfulness Research Monthly. It's put out by an academic called David Black. You can just Google that. And that is a fantastic way. And also, it's freely offered. So every month, it's the latest digest of all the studies that are done. And what's interesting, I've been tracking this for a while. Initially, there might be a couple of dozen studies that month. Now they're pushing 100 studies a month on mindfulness. The field is really exploding here. So I'm sure there's some good research there. It would just make sense that becoming... Now, there is research, by the way. I should say this. As people become more attuned to themselves through, let's say, a mindfulness practice, the result of that is that they build up layers of cortex. They literally build probably tens of millions of new synapses and the capillaries bringing oxygen and glucose, the little resources that the brain needs. Even though the brain is just 2 to 3% of body weight, it uses 20 to 25% of the metabolic supplies in our blood. You know, it runs hot. It's so busy. It's working so much. Well, anyway, people who routinely do a mindfulness practice and tune into themselves build up layers of cortex in a part of the brain called the insula. There are two of them inside the temporal lobes on both sides. And the insula is really the place in the brain at the highest level of architecture in neural mental processing that produces a map of oneself. It's the foundation of self-awareness. It's in the insula that we really form a very high level map of what's going on in our body at any moment in time, as well as what we're feeling, especially our deeper gut feelings. So, interestingly, studies have shown that people who routinely tune in to themselves develop a thicker insula, and second, they become more empathic to the emotions of other people. They become more attuned to the feelings of others. Not just attuned to the actions of others. That's what those mirror-like networks are about, which to me is an important but lesser importance aspect of empathy, you know, tracking the physical movements of the other person, but being able to attune to their emotions through the insula, or track, frankly, in the third component of empathy through theory of mind faculties in the prefrontal cortex, to be able to track their thoughts, their motivations, their dynamics, you know, their attitudes, their personality factors, and so forth. Anyway, to be able to track all that is really important, and tuning into oneself builds up layers in the insula, which then lets us resonate with and be attuned to the emotions of others in proportion to the degree to which those layers of cortex were thickened in the insula. So that's a very good foundation in research that speaks directly to your question.
It's fascinating. So the brain, in a way, is actually growing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is really literally like building a muscle,
yes.
You know. Yeah. And... for better or worse. I mean, the brain is constantly changing its structure. The only question is it for better or worse?
Yes, yes. So maybe let's touch on, you know, therapists that maybe have high caseloads, very challenging clients. What are some simple mindfulness approaches that maybe their therapists can have running in the background when they're working and maybe feeling the effects of stress and anxiety?
Yeah. Well, First off, I think that there's actually a lot in our tradition. I mean, there's a kind of phenomenon of old wine in new bottles. I'm old enough and I've been in the field long enough that I've seen various cycles where teachings that were in the 30s, in the last century actually, or in the 50s of the last century have been kind of repackaged with new language. But it's pretty much very familiar stuff. For example, if you think about people like Jung, Carl Jung, in terms of the upper reaches of human potential, or Abraham Maslow with self-actualization and so forth, that was very much about positive psychology. But now, right, in the last 10, 20 years, there's been this resurgence of interest in positive psychology, but it was not invented, you know, in the last 10 or 20 years. And in terms of mindfulness, being mindful to oneself so that one doesn't get burned out in a busy practice, I think about the attention in psychoanalysis to countertransference, to appreciating one's own reactions, like, for example, anxiety to a difficult or hostile couple, which gets me too, because I'm a softie and also a little bit anxious by nature. And so, you know, I think that's, you know, the attention to one's own countertransferential reactions to situations is a kind of inner mindfulness.
Yes.
In addition, I like the idea of being able to find refuge. Because if we don't have, if you think about attachment theory, if we don't have a secure base, it's difficult to go out and explore. It's hard to assert oneself. And it's hard to be fully present over there if we don't feel like we have a secure base over here. And obviously, for a year-and-a-half-old child, that secure base, hopefully, is a secure attachment relationship with various caregivers that's become increasingly internalized. As adults, how do we as therapists find our own secure base, our own place of refuge while dealing with difficult people? Or people who are not difficult, but what they're feeling is difficult, which is what I'm really trying to say. So for myself, I will often, when I'm feeling, when I'm starting through that tracking of my own reactions, if you will, noticing that I'm getting maybe really sleepy or just sort of keyed up or discombobulated, that's a nice fancy word, discombobulated, by what's going on with the couple I'm seeing or the individual I'm seeing or the kid I'm working with because I have a large mixed practice. One thing I'll do is I'll try to come back to center. I'll try to recall a felt sense in my body when I was peaceful or calm, or I felt strong. I'll call up, for example, times I've spent rock climbing or times I spent with my wife, who totally loves me, and so I feel really loved. And so I can re-access those felt experiences, activate them so they become mental states, and then because they're more present in my awareness, I can then go forward with my client in a stronger, clearer way.
That's wonderful, because, I mean, that's something that you can really do in the here and now as you're observing yourself, as you're being mindful of your reactions.
Yeah.
I love that idea of just calling on those states and their experiences, I guess, that are stored in your memory. You're not making them up.
That's right. I think I've been thinking a lot lately, partly related to what I'm writing now, about activation and installation and reactivation. That cycle is so much of what we do in psychotherapy. We try to help clients activate positive states, or when they do, we try to slow things down so they can stay with that particular state of mind, because especially these days we have a growing understanding that mental states become neural traits. So we're trying to help them stay with that positive mental state long enough to install it. So there's learning, right? And I think there's no way around it. I mean, the brain is constantly activating states and it's constantly installing states. Neurons that fire together wire together. Question is, of course, you know, is it for better or worse? And to kind of see this in a clear-eyed way, demystified way, has been very helpful to me.
And I love your whole teachings around taking in the good as well. It's something I use a lot in my practice, but helping clients really expand states and particularly working with couples, noticing when couples miss each other, they miss the kind of good stuff that's coming to them from their partner, and kind of catching that and getting them to expand that. So, you know, I love the whole philosophy behind that, and it's really effective to see that play out when you help a client catch it and stay with it.
I know. Like I was saying earlier, and I lost my track a little bit, these four ways that therapists teach things, essentially, or draw, help good things happen. One is we just do it in the flow, but the second is we actually name it to people. We actually say, you know, by the way, this is my quick version of this, by the way, the brain has a negativity bias. What that means is that it registers just like that, negative experiences, but positive ones, unless they're million-dollar moments, have ordinary memory systems. That means you have to stay with it a dozen or so seconds straight for it to transfer from short-term memory buffers down into long-term storage. But how often do we actually do that? It's quite rare. So positive experiences flow through the brain like water through a sieve, but negative ones get caught every time. That's why it's really important. Client, you know, a dozen seconds at a time, privately. No one needs to know you're doing this. It's top secret. A dozen seconds at a time, a handful of times a day, when you're having a good experience, a mild one probably, stay with it. And then sense and intend that it's sinking in. So that's the second way. We teach it to people. And I find people love this method because it's positive. It makes sense. They get it. I use my phrase, you know, the brain's like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. They go, yeah, it's like that. Third thing we do is we explicitly do it with them in the session. So, for example, they're having a positive experience. We might say something like, hey, let's stay with this for a moment here. I'll maybe even be quiet for a moment. I won't stare at you or anything. Just, we'll take half a minute. Get a sense of this really going into you, like water into a sponge, or if you're a kid, like a jewel into the treasure chest in your heart. So that's the third way. We do it with people. And then the fourth way we help good things happen as therapists is we encourage people to do things outside of sessions, whether explicitly, like with CBT, homework sheets, and things like that, or in this case, like with a little practice at the end of the night before going to sleep or maybe at a meal. And to be clear, this is not the power of positive thinking, because positive thoughts have almost no traction. What has traction in the brain are emotions and sensations, particularly sustained, whole body, personally relevant emotions and sensations. That's what really has traction. That's what sinks in. And second, gratitude alone doesn't do that much for people, because if you don't feel it for 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row, whoosh, 3 seconds of gratitude, it's a nice 3 seconds, but as far as the brain is concerned, it may as well not have happened at all. You know, Clinton, for me, this perspective on how does learning occur and how can we maximize learning in a frame of psychotherapy with attention to things like transference and all that stuff, it's taken me to a very humbling place, because it's made me realize how much of my own efforts and how many of my clients' hard-won efforts may as well never have happened as far as structure building in the brain is concerned. Very humbling. And so once burned, twice shy, trying to learn my own lesson and practice what I preach, I've started paying a lot more attention to the registration process, whereby learning, as it were, sticks to people's ribs rather than just flowing through them like water through a sieve.
Yes. And I'm hearing there, Rick, you're really highlighting the importance of the experiential. They're really kind of capturing that and doing it with your client, staying with the experience so that you can both savor it in a way.
I know, and I'll admit it to myself, maybe I'm not the only therapist in the world that's like this. You know, I've really come to appreciate that my brilliant ideas or my clever languaging of my clients' issues, it has a little benefit. Once in a while, it really lands. But to quote a psychoanalyst from the 30s, and I don't think it's coincidental that it was a woman, she said, the patient does not need a new idea. The patient needs a new experience. Because we don't suffer our ideas. We don't suffer our cognitions. We suffer the emotions and sensations and desires those cognitions lead to. But the cognitions themselves are just passing thoughts, right? So, yes, it's important to change cognitions, but the point of changing cognitions is to change sensations, emotions, and desires. And oftentimes, the cognitions actually are the tail of the dog. that if we can get people to shift their experiences, as you said, the experiential, the embodied aspects, we get them to shift, or we help them activate and then install a new set of sensations, emotions, and desires, the cognitions will follow.
It's beautiful. I love that phrase. It's fantastic. And something just to keep in the background of when you are talking about ideas and concepts with clients, that we, you know, thinking, how can we actually make this come alive between us?
Yeah. I mean, a little detail, another one that where I think neuroscience doesn't have much to offer to a lot of psychotherapy. And for example, if you're reading an article or listening to someone talk, even me, God forbid, and you can just replace the neuro speak with ordinary, perfectly fine psychological terminology, there's no value added really in going neurological. What's the value added? If you're a neurologist or a neuroscientist and you're interested in the mapping of mental and neural activity, okay, getting a correlation adds value. But otherwise, I mean, for example, if I were to say, you know, that guy looked at me cross-eyed and I got really mad. Or I said, that guy looked at me cross-eyed and my amygdala lit up. How does that add value to say my amygdala did it, you know? So I think there's a fair amount of hooey when it comes to bringing neuroscience into psychotherapy world. And a certain amount of, honestly, it's a way to seem impressive. But there are some places where I think neuroscience has really made some contributions. And one of them is to highlight certain key things, like as we were speaking, the importance of experience, of embodied approaches in terms of deep learning. Another highlight is to appreciate the importance of moderate arousal, because in moderate states of energization or vitality, and by arousal I don't mean erotic arousal, obviously, moderate arousal is involved with levels of dopamine, a neurotransmitter, and we're also a neurotransmitter that's associated sometimes with stress, but moderate levels of norepinephrine are basically fine. Norepinephrine, dopamine tracks rewards. It doesn't usually give us the experience of pleasure or joy or reward, but it tracks reward. And when it dips, that does help us feel bad and creates craving. Okay, so we have dopamine, moderate arousal tracks moderate dopamine. Then norepinephrine, moderate states of arousal, lead to moderate states of alertness and orienting and paying attention. Well, dopamine and norepinephrine promote synaptic formation. In other words, dopamine and norepinephrine as neurotransmitters promote the building of new structure. They promote neuroplasticity. Well, if we want to help our clients learn things, right, or change or grow or shift or have learning stick to their ribs, if they're, kind of a nerd, low energy, slow. Yeah, doc, I just spend another week like all weeks. Or we are the therapist, or I'm the therapist, droning along about my analysis of their issues and whatever. Blah. There's no energy in the room. And no energy means no dopamine and no norepinephrine. So I've gotten much more alert to using humor, waving my arms, you know, doing things, walking, going for a walk outside the building sometimes, you know, getting clients more involved, getting them to do silly things, joking around more with them, anything sometimes to get the energy up, because that promotes learning.
Yes, yes. I'm so enjoying our conversation, and I'm so appreciative for you giving up your time today, Rick. Oh. Just to kind of close off, are there any resources you can recommend? I know you've touched on a couple in your talk. For therapists that maybe want to pursue, you know, more mindfulness approaches or looking into this whole area.
Oh, great. Okay. So, and by the way, Glenton, it's been an honor, actually, to have this chance to talk with you and through you, hopefully, to other people. Well, there's a lot that's been done around mindfulness in psychotherapy and the mindful therapist, for example. So Dan Siegel has done a lot of good work there. I'm blanking on the name of another one of his colleagues. It'll come to me. I know Bonnie Badenoch has done a lot of stuff. Ronald Siegel has done tremendous work on mindfulness and psychotherapy. Chris Germer. I think my own material, my two books, as well as the freely offered resources on my website go there as well. I think If I could just add to it one more thing, it's to broaden the notion of mindfulness to include contemplative practice in general, and to bring in, honestly, the great many people who have a theistic component to their mindfulness practice. In other words, they, for them, there's a dimension of prayer that's really important here. And so unless one is doing an explicitly Christian, you know, psychotherapy, let's say, or something like that, maybe in a different tradition, obviously it's inappropriate to present ourselves as a religious teacher to a client, but to be open-minded about the role of prayer in the life of many, many people, in reference to the divine by whatever name or concept or no name at all, you know, to appreciate the importance of that, I think is ecumenical in the best sense of the word, and inclusive as well. It's kind of a diversity issue, and if we exclude from the big tent of psychotherapy people whose mindfulness is rooted in a very theistic tradition, you know, then we're leaving people out. So, and I say one last thing, and you know, just to kind of sum up here, there's no replacement for personal practice.
Yes.
You know, you can get, there's some momentum. If you have a decent base of mindfulness in yourself, you can get away with. I think of this famous piano player. I wish I could recall his name. He was a man. He said, if I do not practice, he practiced, you know, 3 to 5 hours a day. World-class concert pianist, very famous. If I could remember his name, you'd recognize it. But anyway, he said, if I do not practice one day, I notice it. If I do not practice 2 days in a row, my wife notices it. And if I do not practice 3 days in a row, the whole world notices it. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit like that. So I think we can sometimes get away with a little bit of slipping and sliding, but then we need to get back on the horse and we need to build up our personal momentum of practice. So I personally have taken kind of a vow to meditate every day, at least 1 minute or more. And occasionally it's that 1 minute before I fall asleep, usually better. I aim for 45 minutes a day. But I really encourage people, do your own practice. And bit by bit, you know, as they say in Tibet, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves. Yeah. So if we just bring a quality of mindfulness to the minutes of our day, both some formal minutes in our day, the years will take care of themselves.
Well, thank you, Rick. You really are a breath of fresh air in the world of psychotherapy. Huh. And could I also just recommend to those people that are viewing, on your website, rickhanson.net, you have a wonderful store there, and I've certainly sent many of my clients and purchased them myself your audio books. You have a number of audio books there with lots of lovely practical meditations that anyone can use, clients and practitioners.
That's right. Thank you, Clinton, for saying that. And there's a lot of free material there as well.
Yes. Well, thank you. I really appreciate your generosity and your time. And I hope we can speak again sometime, Rick.
Oh, anytime. Australia. Go Australia.
Thank you. Well, bye for now.
Take care. Take care, everybody.
See you.